We're getting here with the Mishnah on the bottom of Kufchet Amud Bet. The Mishnah says, "Aposek ma'ot l'chotno." Here, a future father-in-law puts together a package which he says he's going to give to his future son-in-law. Upashat lo et haregel, and this is where the modern term comes from. Tipshot regel means to declare bankruptcy in the modern parlance in Hebrew. But here in the Mishnah, it's not clear here, upashat lo et haregel. That's obviously something that is of a negative ilk. Rashi brings two interpretations of it. He says it's alashon bizayon. It's definitely a denigrating type of term that a person says, you know what, take the dirt off of the bottom of my feet, meaning that I don't really care, I can't do anything for you. Or he brings the alternative of, you can hang me up by my feet, meaning turn me upside down and shake my pockets or shake me down and there's nothing going to come out of here, there's no money coming out of here. Or others say, Pashat the Deregel means he outstretched his foot. He took off. He left the place because he wasn't going to pay back. So he basically defaulted on all his payments because he walked out of town. That's what it means of Pashat the Deregel. But it's not clear here whether it means that he is bankrupt and unable to pay it, or whether he is refusing to pay it. But one of the two, Pashat lo et Deregel, means he just sticks his foot out as if to trip him up, or as if to be bo'etbo, sticks his foot out as if too bad. The difference in how you explain the language might have to do with the difference in what you think happened over here. Whether you think there was bankruptcy, or you think that he simply defaulted and he's refusing to pay. Even though you might have the means by which to make good on the payment. So then, teshev ad shetalbin rosha. This young lady will stay there until her hairs turn white, meaning that the chatan has no obligation now to take her as a wife, and she is stuck in this limbo state until her father makes good on the promises that he made. So now Tosafot already brings from the Yerushalmi, says, Muki la Yerushalmi kishepasak b'mamada, that this all happened in her presence. So that she was, in a sense, a party to this. Avalo pasak b'mamada, afilu rabbanan modu. Then even the rabbanan agreed that she is not responsible. Because when she's there, and her father's making all these promises, she's a big enough girl where she should speak up and say that he's just bluffing, or we don't have this, we're not going to be able to do this, and he's not going to do this. And therefore, she becomes a party to the transaction. And becoming a party to the transaction, then the penalty applies to both parties, meaning to her as well as to her father, that she's going to sit around in this limbo state of being in Kedushin Erus Sin without consummation. So she can't marry anybody else. She can't marry this guy until her father fulfills the obligations that he set out. Admon Omer, Yochola hi shite amar. Ilo ani pasakti latzmi, eshev ajital bin roshi. If I undertook this, then I'd sit around until my hair turned white, because then I'm responsible for it. Achshav she'abo pasak, but here it's my father who did this. Ma ani yochola lasot. What could I do in this situation? Oknos, optor. Take your choice. Either you marry me or you release me. You can't hold me in this in limbo state. Amar Rabban Gamliel, roe ani et divrei Admon. What Admon says makes a lot of sense to me. That's what Rabban Gamliel says, that the obligation is on the father, not on the daughter. And since it's on the father, not the daughter can make a demand of him either to act or don't act. Fine, you know now that you're not getting the money. So make your choice. Either you marry me or release me so that I can go marry someone else. But as far as I'm concerned, take action now that you have the new information in hand. The question is, why is Beit Din not entering into the fray here and demanding that this individual or this father pay money? We had learned earlier that Dvarim Shepasku, things that they agreed to in the Tanaim at the time of the Kiddushin, Hein Hein Dvarim Shebe'amira, these are things that even though they are committed orally, that they have the enforcement of the equivalent of a shtar. And therefore, you could extract them by shtar. Beit Din could be yorei the nechasav, could go after his property, and they should be able to extract the money from the father against his will. And if he so chooses not to pay it, they should be able to go after it because he has now contractual obligations based on the fact that these were tnaim that were at the time of Kiddushin. So according to the version, or to those that read it here, that he's bankrupt, there's nothing to go after. He doesn't have any assets, so why bother? You can't do anything over here. Beit Din entering into the fray is not going to help because he doesn't have anything to pay with. But going into the more likely scenario where he's simply refusing to pay, why doesn't Beit Din intervene over here? So the Rashbam says over here, Hani Mili, that we say, Amdu v'kidshu kanu, that statement that Rav Gidol said earlier, Rav Gidol Merav, said that Amdu v'kidshu kanu, that there's a full-fledged kinyan associated with the Tanaim, is only Hani Mili, the kidshu miyad, mitoch atnaei, ol achar zman, v'izkir atnaim v'shat kidushin. It's what we mentioned earlier by the Tosafot, that it's only when it's in the framework of kidushin, do the Tanaim take on the strength or the power of the Kinyan of the Kiddushin. But if they're totally separate negotiations, then one has nothing to do with the other. You can't say that the Kiddushin automatically locks in the Tanaim because they weren't in context together. Unless you mention the Tanaim again at the time of Kiddushin. If you mention them, then they can be subsumed under the Kiddushin. Aval hitnu ata v'kidei shlach hazman. If they came to an agreement now and only had Kiddushin later, v'lo izkiru atanaim, and they don't mention them, lav dvarim aniknim ba'amirahim. These are not things that just by an oral agreement would be binding. And therefore, that's the difference between this and the case before. The cases before are talking about where they had the Tanaim and they did Kiddushin immediately. And therefore, the Tanaim are binding with the force of a full force kinyan. Over here, it's talking about they came to this agreement beforehand, then they had the marriage, nothing to do with the Tanaim. And therefore, they're not binding in that way. That's why Beit Din can't enter in. That's why he can't force the father to pay over here. If the Tanaim were subsumed under the Kinyan Kiddushin, then he could compel the father to pay because he can enter the Beit Din. Now he has a shtar, Kinyan, and he can go after the father for the money. But now that he doesn't have that, he has no rights. All he has is this oral commitment that is not bound by a Kinyan, and now it won't be enforceable in court. And that's why she's stuck in this difficult position. So that's one way to explain the difference. The other way that Tosafot brings from the Yerushalmi distinguishes over here and says, "Vani chipasti b'Yerushalmi matzati b'reish afalpi d'achter Rav Gidol davka b'nisuin arishonim." It only applies by the first nisuin. B'davka hava posek ayidei bito, and it's only when the father does it on behalf of his daughter. V'lo isha ayidei bita, v'lo ach ayidei achoto. So what he says is this is only applicable in the first marriage. It's not applicable to a second marriage. So when do we say that the Tanaim are bound by the Kinyan Kiddushin? According to the Yerushalmi, that's qualified by the fact that it has to be the first marriage. If it's a second marriage, it fails. It could fail for a number of reasons. One possibility is what Tosafot's mentioning here. It's the Rabbanon, which is here. It's her mother or a brother who's making the commitment. And therefore, we're talking about Kiddushin the Rabbanan. Maybe they don't have that power. Maybe the Rabbanan didn't invest their Kiddushin with that power to grant a Kinyan on the Tanaim. Or it simply might be that the Kiddushin itself is considered to be the consideration, or the Hanat Kiddushin is what generates the Kinyan between the parties. It might be that in a second marriage, the Hana is not at that level as it was with the first marriage. And therefore, it just doesn't reach the level at which you would say that the Kinyan is enough binding power to bring in the Tanaim as well. So that's another way to explain it, that this is a case of second Kiddushin, or second marriage, and that's why there's no binding of the Tanaim over here. But you see that Tosafot's already grappling with the issue as to why we can't compel the father to pay. Why is the commitment that he made in the Tanaim not binding over here, like we saw in the other parak? Previous parak, we talked about that. That was such a central idea that you could actually create commitments that would be bound by the Kiddushin. How come that's not the case here? So Tosafot is trying to differentiate this case from what we saw in the previous parak. All right, now the Gemara begins. Matnitan deloki haitana. Our Mishnah is clearly not like this Tanya. The Tanya, we have a Braita that is a slightly different version of our Mishnah. Amar Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Yehuda, lo nechluku admon v'chachamim ala posek ma'ot lechotno u'pashat lo et haregel shecholahi sheteamer abba pasak alai ma ani yechola la'asot. Here, basically, the claim of admon is taken up both by the chachamim and admon, which is that the girl can say, that's my father, that's me, and you can't blame me for what my father did. So then, amma nechluku, where is the machloka between Admon and the Chachamim? Al shepaskahi al atzma, where she actually made the commitment herself. Chachamim omrim teshev ashel debin rosha. She should sit around until she gets white hair because it's her own fault. She entered into this agreement. She's the one who made such a commitment. Therefore, she's on the hook for it and she's stuck. Arman Omer, Yecholahi Shetemar, Kizvurani, She'aba Notein Alai. I thought that my father would step up and take care of me. Tafshav She'aba Notein Alai. Now that I see my father is not willing to back up my commitments, Mani Yecholah Lasot. I don't have independent wealth or assets. So what can I do? Oknos, optor. Make your decision. If you like me without the money and the assets, then marry me. If you don't, just let me go. Release me, but don't hold me in abeyance here because you're trying to extract the money that was, or the commitments that were made over here. So in this instance, you have to say the opposite, which is that she made the commitment in front of her father. If her father's not present, the fact that the daughter made the commitment should have no binding power at all. But here we're assuming that she made the commitment in front of the father. The father didn't say anything. So now the question is the father not saying anything mean that he backs up the daughter's commitment? Or in the end, is it the daughter's commitment? And the father could say, I don't have anything to do with this. I never made such a commitment. And then the question is, what's her ability now to extract herself from the problem? The Chachamim said she put herself in, she's stuck. Admon says, listen, she did rely on her father. And the fact that her father's not stepping up, so don't trap her in the marriage because her father won't step up. Release her or take her, but don't lock her into this marriage. You're not getting the money any faster or any better just because you lock her into this state of limbo. Right? So here again, you have the same problem you have in the Mishnah, which is he can't go to court and enforce the claim. Because here he relied on this woman who doesn't have any assets. He shouldn't have relied on her. The fact that the father's present, do you say that his silence was acquiescence? Or do you say that his silence was, okay, she can do whatever she wants, I'm not paying up. But the problem in both these cases is he doesn't have a court enforceable way to get to the money. That's why he's using the woman as leverage to try to get what the was committed over here. And in both cases, Admon says, don't use the woman as the pivot, because she doesn't have the capabilities. Either in the first case, in our Mishnah, she wasn't the one who committed it, or in the second case, even if she was the woman who committed it, she doesn't have the ability to pay it. So her father's refusal to pay should not trap her in either of these cases. All right. Amar Rabban Gamliel, Roe Ani et Divrei Admon. So once again, Rabbi Gamliel says that I subscribe to this position of Admon. Tana, Bameh Dvarim Amurim. About what is this said? Bameh Dvarim Amurim is already a qualification of a statement that we made before. Now Rashi claims that Tana over here references the Braita that we just brought. So this is a qualification of the Braita. Almost everybody else disagrees with Rashi and thinks it's referencing to the Mishnah. It's a qualification of the Mishnah. Bameh Dvarim Amurim, Big Dola. That's only true by Gdola. Aval Big Tana, when we're talking about a minor, Kofin. We compel him. Kofin the man. Who do we compel over here? Exactly the question. Kofin, there are a number of parties that can be forced over here, right? There is the father-in-law, the future father-in-law can be compelled to pay. Or there is the future son-in-law who can compel to either act, to marry or to divorce. Ilei Malav, if you say that it's the father, Ipcho Mibayile, it should be just the opposite. Because over here, what does it say? It says, that's true by a Gdola. But by Ktana, we would enter in to intervene. We would intervene in the case of the Ktana to force the father to pay up. Now here, this is evidence to those people that believe that the Pashat Lo Et HaRegel in the Mishnah was not a case of bankruptcy, but a simple case of his refusal to pay. Otherwise, Kofin Oto, what are you forcing him to do? If he's bankrupt and he has no money, compelling him is not going to do anything over here. So the fact that the Gemara here entertains Kofin already indicates that they think that there's still money there that they can extract from this individual. Now, that's especially important if you think that the Tan over here is modifying the Mishnah. According to Rashi, where it's modifying the Braita, maybe you have a little more room to work. But according to most of the Rishonim, where it's modifying the Mishnah, that shows you that there are assets left in the estate to go after. Otherwise, Kofin is not a meaningful statement of the Gemara. Now, the Gemara says, we'll work with it. First, let's work on the Mishnah. So the Mishnah says, Bameh Dvarim Amurim Bigdolam. Our mission is only time at Gdola. By Bektana, we would enter into the fray and have the father pay up. So now, the opposite should be true. Because in the case of Ektana, the father is responsible for the Ktana, number one. Number two is, the Ktana is Ektana. She's not at the age where she's on the precipice of going beyond the point where she's of marriageable age. On the other hand, the Gdola, who is in some ways independent of her father, and on the other hand, she's also at the age where she needs to get married. So in that instance, we would come in and help out and enter, force the father. But to say the other way around, that by Gdola, we would just say, too bad, and by Ktana, we'd enter into the fray and force the father-in-law to pay in here, doesn't make any sense. Why by Ktana would you do that and not for a Gdola? So that's why it would be the opposite in the case of our Mishnah. According to Rashi, who says that this is modifying the Braita, the reason that you would say the opposite is because here the daughter made the commitment. She's the one who opened up the negotiation and made a commitment. If you're talking about a Ktana who made a commitment, then the Chatan should have no expectations of getting paid because she doesn't have an ability to create Tnaim or to create any commitments. So then, in that case, why would you compel the father to pay? On the other hand, if it's a Gdola who is making the commitment, in that instance, then we would be more likely to engage and force the father to pay here because a Gdola who has the ability to enter into transactions created the transaction over here. In this case, again, what might have compelled Rashi or a number of reasons to explain it on the Braita, but one of the reasons might be that the case of the Braita is more likely when you say Pashat Lo Taregel is a case where the daughter made a commitment and the father is refusing to pay. In that case, it sounds more like a default rather than a bankruptcy because the commitment was made by the daughter and the father says, I'm just not going to uphold it. And then in that case, Kofin makes sense that you'd enter in and try to compel him to do it. In the case of the Mishnah, maybe Rashi is reading a Pashat Lo Taregel differently than he's reading in the Braita, but there the father made the commitment and now he's not paying up. There it's more likely because he can't pay up at this point and therefore he's bankrupt and Kofin Oto is not going to do you anything. That might have been what compelled Rashi to explain it on the Braita instead of the Mishnah. But clearly the other Rishonim explained on the Mishnah that Pashat et Aregel, it means not a bankruptcy, but rather a default, and therefore he can compel him. We can't go after him. Because Rashi on the Mishnah explains the Pashat Aregel, says Vanisha Mati. Here is, I heard a different explanation. Talo tielaitz, feinli malitain. Hang me by my foot, you know, upside down. Shake me down. Shake out my pockets. Nothing's going to come out. I have nothing to offer. Which sounds like bankruptcy. And not the case of just simply refusal to pay. So, Ela Marava, kofin la baal litain get. So, he says, this is a case where we force the husband to give a get. So now, in this instance, if you say it's referencing to the Mishnah, then we say, Bamed or Imamurim Big Dola. In the case of Gdola, Aval Big Tana, by the case of a Ktana, we would compel him to give her a get and not lock her in. Now, Rava says here, we compel the Baal to give a get. So now, the Gemara says here, that's Bamed or Imamurim Big Dola. In the case of a Gdola, there we leave the Mishnah intact. By a Ktana, we compel him to give a get over there. And that might have to do with the fact that a Ktana is either not able to reject what her father's overtures were originally and say, look, he was lying, he can't pay this, he's making commitments that he's not going to live up to. She doesn't have that ability. So to say that he's going to hold her ransom to get the payment from the father is just not fair because the Ktana is just not aware of what's going on. And the other hand, in the case of the Braita as well, Ktana who makes commitments, how could have the husband really relied on commitments of the Ktana? And you can't blame her that the father's not paying now. Let her go. Release her. She's a Ktana. A Gdola enters into commitments. All right. There already, there's something to talk about. All right. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Lazar, Mishmei Dechizkia, Kol Makom Shema Rabban Gamliel Roe Ani Adivrei Admon, Halacha Kimoto. Anywhere where it says in the Mishnah, seemingly, that Rabban Gamliel agrees to the position of Mon, the Halacha is this way. Now, as the Reed points out over here, with the exception of what we said yesterday, because the Rabbeinu Tam already brought yesterday on the first Mishnah that we brought with Admon, that even though Rabban Gamliel agrees with Admon there, the halacha is not like him. By the case of the Banot and the Ben, where the Ben gets knocked out of the Yerusha when there aren't sufficient assets, and the girls get to be sustained out of the estate, and the boys have to go around and collect money, over there the Rabbeinu Tam, and I mentioned that yesterday, said that the halacha is not like this, even though here the Gemara makes a definitive statement. Whenever Rabban Gamliel agrees with Admon, the halacha is that way. Nevertheless, we don't paskin that way in that case. Amalei Rava, the Rav Nachman. So Rava asked Rav Nachman, Afilu Bebraito, you made a statement that didn't define where this is true. Is this only true when you find Rabbi Gamliel supporting the position of Admon in a Mishnah? Or is that also true when you find him supporting him in a Braita? Amalei, Mika Amrinu B'Mishnah. Did I qualify my statement? Did I say that in a Mishnah? I simply made a statement. Anytime Rabbi Gamliel agrees with Admon, the Lachas Kemoto. Bechol makom, shamar Rav Gamliel, kamrinan. Wherever he agrees with Admon, that's what I say. Now, which brayta we're referring to over here? Rashi claims it's the brayta above, once again. And the problem with that is very obvious. Tosafot already raises it, as well as other Rishonim, is that the brayta is a stira to the Mishnah. The brayta itself disagrees with our Mishnah. It says, Alma nechleku. It says that they all agree in the case where the father made the commitment. Our Mishnah is talking about a case where the father made the commitment. So by definition, if we say Alacha ki admon in the brayta, then you have a problem because the brayta is not in concert with the Mishnah. So most Rishonim say, what does it mean by brayta? Means any other brayta. If we find it somewhere else, do we say that it is Alacha kamoto? As long as it's not a stira to a Mishnah. In our case over here, the brayta is a stira to the Mishnah, therefore we won't say it. Rashi, on the other hand, says, no, it's referencing this brayta over here. And that's what Tosafot says. V'yish lomar achi perusho. V'afilu b'brayta klomar l'mayt esvir le detana de brayta. De b'piska hi atzma plige kamar tehilchuta kabate. So even though the brayta does argue with the Mishnah, there's a second section of the brayta, which is not mentioned in our Mishnah, and therefore could stand alone. And basically what he says is the locha like that. Which is, okay, as far as the brayta saying that there's no machloket by the Abba, that's just not true. Because our Mishnah says there is. But the second case where it says where she makes the commitment, there's a machloket, is the halacha like Admon in that case. So you could have it, and that's what Rashi is probably saying over here, you could have it that the halacha is like the Mishnah and the Braita in the areas that they argue. So as far as the Mishnah is concerned, the halacha is like Admon where the father makes the commitment, and according to the Braita, the halacha is like Admon when the daughter makes the commitment. The fact that the Mishnah is wrong, that there's no argument, and the Gemara clearly said that this Tana is not like our Mishnah, that's not meaningful because as far as that's concerned, we're going with the Mishnah. So we're going with the Mishnah. So if we separate the cases out, then you could say the Halacha is like Admon in both of these instances, and that might be what Rashi is thinking. All right. Amar Rabbi Zeira, Ami Rabba Bar Yirmiya, Bet Tvarim Shamar Chanan, Halacha Ki Yotzebo. The two things that Chanan said, the Halacha is like him. The word Ki Yotzebo is very ambiguous, and the Gemara is going to try to figure out what that means. Shiva Dvarim Shamar Admon, the seven things that Admon says, Ein Halacha Ki Yotzebo. The Nacha is not like him. Now, again, what this term in Kiyotzibo means. My Kalmar. What is he saying over here? Ilay Machi Kalmar. Shnei Devarim Shamar Chanan Alacha Kimoto. If you say that, when it comes to Chanan, the two things are like him. Ukiyotzibo. Vishivet Varim Shamar Admon. Ain Alacha Kimoto. Velo Kiyotzibo. That the Lacha is not like him. And Kiyotzibo similar to him. Vama Rabbi Yitzchak Ben Elazar. Din Rabbi Yitzchak Ben Elazar Mishmei Dechizya Komakom Shamar Rabban Gamliel. Didn't we just have that? That there is a cases when Admon Allah is like him. So what the Gemara is trying to do is reconcile between the statement that we had before, which Rabbi Yitzchak ben Elazar Mishmei Dechizkiya. Now even though that's a memra of Amoraim, it seems that this was well accepted by the Gemara. Chizkiya is a very early Amora, and because of that it seems that the Gemara accepted that as a given. And therefore it's not willing to undermine that in the explanation of another statement of a later Amora. So because of that, we have to say, we know for sure the Halacha is like Chanan in the two cases he speaks. As far as Admon is concerned, we know that when Rabbi Gamliel agrees with him, that the Halacha is like him. So now, when we said before that the Halacha is like him, ukiyotzebo, now kiyotzebo can mean two things. Rashi claims that it means when someone else, when there's another Tana that corroborates their statement. So in the case of Chanan, right, we have Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai corroborating Hanan's position versus the Bnei Kohanim Gedolim. And in the case of Admon, we have Rabban Gamliel corroborating the statement of Admon. So when the Gemara here says, Halacha kechanan ukiyotzebo, means that anywhere that Hanan speaks in the Mishnah, and he has support from Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the Halacha is like him. Well, that's all the cases. Hanan speaks in two cases, both cases, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai supports him. And as far as Admon is concerned, the Halacha is not like him. Ukiyotzebo, and even when he's supported by Rabban Gamliel, the Halacha is still not like him. Which goes against that statement that we just brought from Chizkiya, that when Rabbi Gamliel supports him, the Halacha is like him. So that's the way Rashi reads it. The Rabbeinu Chanano, and you can see Tosafot also, believes that Ukiyotzebo has a different meaning over here. Ukiyotzebo does not mean like him, but in derivative cases. I mean, the Halacha is like him, plus, the halacha is like him if you extrapolate from this case. So that means that the halacha is like Chanan, And you can extrapolate from Hanan to other cases. And then we say over here, right, Admon, the halacha is not like Admon, and you can't extrapolate from that to any other cases. In both instances, whether you explain it like the Rabbeinu Hanan or Rashi, the problem arises from Chizkiya's statement, which is, we don't have an across-the-board din with Admon. According to Chizkiya, sometimes we pass like Admon, that's when Rav Gamliel supports him, in the three cases at least, although the Rabbeinu Tam leaves out one of them. The other four cases, we do not paskin like him. But that's not a definitive statement that we don't paskin like him. So how are we going to explain this Lashon Kiyotzebo to match up with that statement of Chizkiya? So now the Gemara says, we have a problem now reconciling this. Elohachi kamar. Shnei davarim shechanan alocha kamoto kiyotzebo. These two things, alocha is like him. And you can extrapolate the din from there. Or, according to Rashi, the loch is like him, and those that support him, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Shiva Dorim Sharman Mon, ain't a loch ki yotze bo. The loch is not extrapolated from him, according to the Rabbi Yochanan. Hakamoto, a loch bekulo. But the loch is like Admon in all of these cases. It's just that you can't extrapolate the din. That's what the kiyotze bo is, according to the Rabbi Yochanan. According to Rashi, means that the locha is like Admon. It's not like Rabban Gamliel. It's not like Rabban Gamliel, meaning that in the case of Rabban Gamliel, corroborates, but it was always like Admon. Well, if the locha is always like Admon, Rabbi Yitzchak ben Elazar, Mishmin de Chizya, Koma Kom, Shemai Rabban Gamliel, Roe Ni, Divrei Admon, Alocha Kamoto, Amarin, only if he corroborated that the locha is like Admon. Lo, Amar, lo. So again, you run into the same problem with this statement of Chizkiya. Eliochi Kamar. This is the final way to read it. Shnei davarim shamar Hanan alacha kamoto ukiyotzebo. The two things that Hanan said, alacha is like him, ukiyotzebo. According to Rashi, it means that when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai supports him, then alacha is like him. According to Rabbeinu Hanan, means the alacha is like him, and we extrapolate the din. Shiva davarim shamar admon, yesh ben shalacha kamoto ukiyotzebo. Some of them, the alacha is like him, ukiyotzebo. Yesh ben shalacha kamoto, and now here the gear says questionable, alacha yotzebo, or ukiyotzebo, and it makes a difference whether now you hold like the Rabbeinu Hananel or Rashi, the Girsa will make a difference. But here we have the Admon, sometimes Allah is like him not. So when is Allah like him? Bekomakom, Shamar Ragamleo, Ronia Divrei Admon, Kimoto, ukiyotzebo. So according to Rashi, Allah Kimoto, ukiyotzebo means like him with the support of Rabban Gamliel. According to Rabbeinu Hananel means Allah is like him, and you can extrapolate the din from there. V'yesh mehen, some of them, Shain Allah Kimoto, the halacha is not like him, and according to Rashi's view, so it is elakiyotzebo, but like the other party. Meaning that like the ones that are supported, that Rabbi Gamliel is obviously supporting the other party there because he doesn't say he's supporting Admon. That's the way Rashi would read it. According to Rabbeinu Hanana, it would be v'yesh ben shen halacha kamoto, ukiyotzebo. The halacha is not like him, ukiyotzebo, and the extrapolation, meaning that the halacha is not like him, and you can't extrapolate from this din. So now the Gemara says, "Bekomakom shemar Gamliel roya niyat v'ir admon alacha kamoto." Anywhere that Gamliel supported his position, alacha is like him. Inach lo. The other cases, it's not that way. All right, next Mishnah, very interesting case. Horer al sadeh. Person comes and makes a claim for a field. He says, "This field is mine, and it was stolen from me." The only problem is v'chu chatum alea be'ed. He is signed on a document of sale for this property. Reuven sold property to Shimon. Reuven selling a property to Shimon. Levi is one of the Edim on the contract. But Levi also shows up and says, you know, that property wasn't Reuven's to sell. It was my property. How did he sell it to Shimon if he didn't own the property? It's my property. The guy says, you signed on the document. What do you mean it's not my property? You are a witness to the transaction. If you're a witness to the transaction, it's clear that you believed it was my property. Admon Omer, Sheni Noachli, Ve'arishon kashe heimenu. The reason I did that is, Reuven is a tough guy. I can't extract the field from Reuven. But if I get into Shimon's hands, I have a much better case and I'm much more likely to get my field back. So I made a decision that was to my benefit. That if I just sign on this document and get the field over to Shimon, I have a better chance of extracting the field and getting it back. So I made a conscious decision to be a party to this and not say anything. Chamim Ramim, Ibeidet Zchuto. He lost his right. Now, many of the Rishonim believe Ibeidet Zchuto means, literally, he has lost his right. Even if he shows up now with Edim and all the evidence in the world that it was his father's field, he cannot get it back because he's basically Modeh, that it wasn't his field by signing on the document. Asah siman la'acher, ibeded zechuto. Even Admon agrees, if he makes this a sign for someone else, he lost his rights. Now, what does that mean, asau siman la'acher? Rashi says over here, you can say, hamuchzakpa. That means the person who bought the property, Shimon. Shimon who bought the property from Reuven, now sells or buys a property adjacent to it. And in selling or buying a property adjacent to it, he also demarcates that property and saying, I own the property to the east of it. And he says, that's my property that I bought from Reuven. So the property that I bought from Reuven is the eastern boundary of this field. That's how he writes it. And then this guy is signed on it. So in that case, even Admon agrees that he lost his rights. Because in that case, he doesn't have the logic that dictated in the first case. The first case says, I'd rather have it in Shimon's hand than Reuven's hand. Over here, where there's another sale going on adjacent, why would he sign as an aide on that, demarcating one of the boundaries as being a field that Shimon bought from Reuven? That he could have objected then. He has no vested interest in seeing the adjacent field be sold. So that's the way that Rashi reads it. Tosafot on the top of the Amud Aleph says that, mitoch halashon mashma de'orer kai, that the person who's selling over here is the orer himself, not the muchzakba. That means that Levi is selling adjacent field. And Levi, in selling an adjacent field, demarcates that the eastern side of that field is a field that was bought by Shimon from Reuven. By defining the field that way and selling it in that manner, that means that he's already given up rights to that field. He doesn't think he has rights to get it. Because otherwise, why is he could have demarcated it and said that that's the field on the eastern side is the one that Shimon bought from Reuven that I have a claim on. And should have defined that he has a claim on the field. The fact that he just wrote into the contract that there's this field on the right side or the eastern side that belongs to Shimon that he bought from Reuven, there ibeded zchuto, even according to Admon. Tosavo does qualify that even though the halacha here is not like Admon, nevertheless, that's only when he's like an aide on this, where he really is, in a sense, admitting to the fact that he has no claim against this field, and Reuven selling it to Shimon is a fine transaction. But in cases where he's not signed on the contract, but he's simply a witness to the fact that the field was sold, over there in that case, his being a witness to the field sold, he can make the claim of Admon, which is, I'd rather have the field in the hands of Shimon than Reuven, because Shimon's easier to extract from. But over here where he signed on the document, that's equivalent of a hoda'ah, it's equivalent of an admission. He should have signed on the document. In a situation where the document's already done and the sale's already done, and now they want to know whose hands it should be in, Reuven's or Shimon's, then he can come in with Admon's claim and say, I'd rather it be in Shimon's hands and I'll testify the fact that it was sold to Shimon than be in Reuven's hands. So Admon's halacha does, in the end, stand, but in a case where the activities are not defined as a hoda'ah, like the case of where you're an aide and you sign on a document, because that's a complete acquiescence. In a case where the documents are done and you have nothing to do with the transaction at all, and now they're coming to ask and figure out whose possession it is and whether there was a sale or not, the fact that you testify about it in that instance, you could make the claim of Admon. Because that's not implicit acquiescence in that case. It's simply trying to get it to the party who you think is easier to extract it from. All right. Amar Abayi, lo shanu ela aid. This is only true if he signs on as an aid. Aval dayan, lo yibeded zechuto. But a judge that signs on a henpek did not lose his rights. So you have the edim who signed on the contract, and then the contract is taken to Beit Din for validation. So the dayanim write a henpek to validate the shtar. If he validates the shtar, he does not lose his rights. Why is that? The Tani Rabbi Chia, ein edim chutmim al hashtar, elim kein karo. Edim cannot sign on a shtar unless they read it. Because the edim are testifying about what's in the shtar. So as they're testifying about what's in the shtar, they better read what they're signing. Because if they don't read what they're signing, then they shouldn't be signing it. I remember I had a case here in the shul. Somebody was writing a dead document between them. They asked me to sign on the document. I read the document. They were like shocked. They just wanted me to be a witness. Right. Why are you reading the document? I said, well, if I'm signing the document, I want to know what's written in it. And there happened to be mistakes in there. I said, I can't sign it the way that it is. They were like shocked that someone would read it before signing it. I said, if you're going to put your signature on something to commit and be an aide on it, you want to know what's written inside of it. Dayanim do not have to read the contract before they sign it, because they are just verifying that the signatories to the contract are valid signatures. They're not validating the content of the contract. They are validating that the contract was signed by real edim, and therefore the contract can be upheld. Okay, now you want to know what's in the contract. You can read that later. They do one simple operation. They match up the signatures to the Edim who verify that their signatures are on this contract. So they're not reading the contract or the content of the contract. Tosafot does bring up cases where they would have to read it, and a case where they know that somebody's acting as an apitropos, then they should double-check the contract to make sure that he's not pretending that he's selling on his own behalf versus the behalf of those parties that he's a custodian for, a guardian for. But in most cases, the dayanim don't have to read the contract, and therefore, when he signs on it, that's not an affirmation that he agrees to what's inside the contract. And therefore, you will not say that he bated zchuto when he's a dayan, signed onto a contract. Now, asalu siman acher. Amar Abayi, lo shanu elo l'acher. Aval le'atzmo, lo yibated zchuto. That's only true if there's a third-party transaction going on. Aval le'atzmo, if he personally is buying it, lo yibated zchuto. There, he hasn't lost his rights. Now, this will all depend on who you think the selling third party is here. If you think it's hamuchzak ba, if you think that, like Rashi, the one who now owns the property is the one selling, then lo yibedet zchuto, the guy who comes now and buys it didn't lose his rights, we'll see why. Damar, idolo abdile, hachi lo avazavin la niale. He would not allow me to purchase the property. Levi's coming now to purchase a property adjacent to the property that he has issues with. And in that contract, it writes, as demarcating the eastern border, this piece of land that says that he has a claim against, and it says it was Shimon's property bought from Reuven. He buys the property given that in the contract. In that situation, does not lose his right, because Ma'id L'chalam Eymar, what could I have said? What do you want me to say in this case? Ibayli L'membsar Moda'a, you want me to now give over a declaration to other Edim and tell them that I'm only signing on this, or I'm only doing this so I can buy the property, not because I really believe that the property adjacent is not mine. Chavra, chavra, chavra idle. Your friend has a friend. Chavra de chavra, chavra idle. And your friend's friend has a friend. When you tell one person, rumors spread. If you go and tell people that you really believe that the field on the eastern side is yours, and that you're only hushing it up because you want to buy the adjacent field and the guy won't sell it to you if he knows that you start making a claim on this field. So that's why you're hushing it up. You go tell 2 Edim that, by the time you get to the transaction, everybody in the town will know about it. Everybody, one guy tells another guy, tells another guy, and by the time that is, it'll be a public issue. So in that instance, he's stuck, and the only way to buy the adjacent property is to allow the seller, who is Shimon, to demarcate the adjacent property based on the fact that he owns the property and he bought it from Reuven, and Levi can't object, otherwise he can't buy it. Tosafot, who thinks it's just the opposite here, the case of Acher is where the individual himself who has the Irur is selling the adjacent property, and he's the one who demarcates the contract when he's selling it and says the field to the eastern side is the field that Shimon bought from Reuven. In that case, you have to change it. He's not buying the field because he already owns the field. He's selling the field, and he's selling the field to Shimon. So that's why Tosafot changes the girsa from Mazbin to Zavin. That Zavin means that he's selling over here, and Levi is selling the adjacent field to Shimon. So now Levi says, I need cash. That's why I'm selling the field. If I tell Shimon that the field on the right side is not really his because I really have a claim on it, he's not going to buy this property from me. He's not going to give me the cash. Because you're going to bring questions about my claim to this property on the eastern side. I'm not buying the property adjacent to it just to enter into the fray and pretend that you have a claim on this property. He'd refuse to buy it because he's not going to put that into a contract that this really belongs to Levi. So therefore, Levi hushes it up in order to get his cash. But he's not hushing it up because he really allowed this to go through. So you have to look carefully. Anytime that Levi is involved in a transaction that puts him as a party that would in some way affirm Shimon's rights to the field, buying it through Reuven, then we say, as according to the Mishnah, ibedet zchuto, he lost his right. But that's only if there's not another reason he would have hushed it up in that case. If there's another reason he would have not declared his irur, then we can say, lo ibedet zchuto. So what are cases where we can say that he's not really giving up his right because there's another reason? One case is where it's a dayan that signed on it. Dayan didn't read the contract. He was simply verifying the signatures. So over there, lo yibedet zchuto. A case where, either according to Rashi, he's buying an adjacent property, or according to the Tosafot, he's selling an adjacent property to Shimon, who is the one mukzak by the one sitting on it now, there he can't be me'arer. Because if he's me'arer, he'll break the other transaction. That won't allow the other transaction to go through. So in order to preserve the transaction that he's entering into now, he has to just look the other way when they say that the field next door belongs to Shimon and not to him. But there, he's not ibeded zchuto. He has a reason. He can explain why he's a party to a transaction which declared it not his field. But if he can't explain it, then ibeded zchuto. Now, interesting case. How dasau siman la'acher? Case here where someone made the field the siman la'acher, ir'er v'shachiv. He made a claim on the field, v'shachiv, and then passed it away. V'ukim apitropa. And he put a guardian in place for the yitomim. So now, the question of, you know, when you have lots of pronouns here, it's not clear who's who. So you can hear, you can have the same case. We'll read it like Rashi. Rashi over here is the case that the father of the Yitomim over here had a field which he claimed was stolen from him and then sold to another party. And then he is a father in adjacent property where he signed on that property saying that the property next door belongs to Shimon and not to him. That doesn't say not to him, but it belongs to Shimon without his irur on it. Then he passes away. He appoints a custodian to take care of the assets of the estate. He had, in his will, he had this written in that this person will be the guardian for the Yitomim. Now the guardian comes to court and says that that field belonged to their father. He was me'arer on the field. It belongs to them. Again, if you think that the acher here is the other party, so other Rishonim think that the person here who holds the property right now is the father. The father had the property. He took possession of it from the other party. But all right, let's leave it. We'll go with Rashi's pshat, which is that it's the father of the Yitomim who had this question about the property, and the guardian is now coming on behalf of the Yitomim to collect it. Ata pitropus l'kamei d'abayi. Amalei abayi, asa siman l'acher, ibeded zchuto. Abayi says, you're coming to claim that property, the property that Reuven sold to Shimon, and now Levi claimed was his, and Levi's now niftar, but he's me'arer that it was his property. I'm sorry, you can't get it, because Levi already signed onto a contract adjacent to it that demarcated it as Shimon's property. So Amar, so the Apitropos says to Abayi, if the father Yitomim was alive, Avatoyin v'amar, he would say, tell him achad asiti lucha. He says, you know what, I granted you one furrow down the field. So he basically says, listen, I own the whole field, but there's one little strip that sits between that field that I have a question about and the field that you sold, an adjacent field that belongs to Shimon. You're right. I gave him that little strip in between. I own the whole field, but I just gave him that little strip. Amalei Shapir Kamart, you are making a good claim. Because, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Im Ta'an Vamar, tell him Echad Asita Lecha Ne'eman. If the person, in a case of our Mishnah, instead of being Ibeded Tzuchuto, says, the reason I said or I signed onto the contract is because I agree, he owns one furrow along the edge here, then that's fine. Ne'eman. So then he can say, I signed off because the eastern border, yeah, Shimon has one furrow on that eastern border. And that's what I meant when they demarcated the borders. So Yochanan says he's Ne'eman to say that. So Zil Havilei, Miu Telem Echad. Abayi says, okay, we'll get you the property, but you're going to have to give Shimon one furrow because you just agreed that he owns one furrow there. Havala Richva Didikle. Problem is that it had a whole row of palm trees on it. That one furrow at the edge, which would make sense, they planted the trees on the edge of the border, both to demarcate the border, as well as to allow you the potential to plant in the inner parts of the field, and they put the trees along the border. So now he has to give up all these trees, which are valuable. He doesn't want to do that. Amalei, Yava Avuan Diyad Mekayam, the father of these Yitomim was alive. Havatoyin Vamar, he would say, Chazarti V'lekachti Mimenu. I went back and bought it back from him. You're right, he owned that little furrow for a while, but I bought it back from him. Amalei Shapir Kamart, again, good claim. Tam Rabbi Yochanan, Intan Vamar Chazarti V'lakaktiv Mimenu Ne'eman. He says, I went and bought it back from him. He's believed. Tam Rabbaye, Haiman Demukim Apitropo. Someone's going to put together a guardian for Yitomim. Nukim Kihai. You should pick a guy like this. Diyad Lapuche B'Zchuta Diyatme. Who knows how to argue on their behalf and to get Zchuyot on their behalf, to get them rights and to win for them. So Abayi says, get a custodian like this, because this guy is great. Now the question is, what was Abayi doing? So Tosafot says, Abayi forgot these halachot, and Ochanami, he forgot the halachot, and this Apitropos reminded him when he was going through this, when he said, made these claims, he goes, you know what, I remember now, Rabbi Yochanan said something like that. But literally, he had forgotten these halachot. That's one approach to it. Others suggest that Abaye was simply testing the guardian. He wanted to see if this guy really was a good guardian on behalf of the Yitomim. So he didn't give him the claims that he could make. He wanted to see if he'd come up with the claims. And that's what he says in the end. This guy's really good. I would use him in other cases. The third possibility is that generally we say that we're toein on behalf of Yitomim, that we make claims on behalf of the Yitomim. That's only true where it's a, call it, normal or regular claim. Something that most people would make a claim like that. It's not some crazy, outlandish type of claim we'll make on their behalf. But this type of claim, where he said, oh, I gave him one furrow on the edge of the field, that's a strange claim. Creative. Very creative. We're not going to do that unless someone makes the claim on their behalf. And that's maybe why Abaye didn't volunteer the information until the Apitropos went ahead and declared it that way. So now, in this instance, the reason that he's believed is because, number one is that he says he owns the field, he can now declare that the piece on the side belongs to the other individual, because he's moded that it belongs to him. Then why is he allowed to reverse it afterwards? It's because the pesha also a pesha hitir. The only reason we know that this guy owns the furrow on the side is because this guy admitted that he gave him the furrow. So when he comes back and says, I bought it back from him, then he's also believed, because the only way we know that it belonged to him is because of him. So it's a pesha also a pesha hitir. That's why he's able to reverse that in the end and say, basically, he owns nothing. I'm going to take the whole field back for the Yitomim. Okay, next Mishnah. Mishalach the Medinat Hayam. Vivda derech sadeu. Went overseas and he lost the entrance to his field. His field is surrounded by other fields. He had access to his fields before he went overseas, but he comes back and he can't find that access route. Or he doesn't remember where that access route is. Now his field is stuck in the middle of all these other fields. And everybody around him is saying, sorry, you didn't have access through here. You can't walk through here. Admon omer yelech lo biktzara. He should pick the shortest route. And we will assume that he has the rights to take that route. He definitely had a route before he left. So now when he comes back, we have to grant him that right. So what is the way to grant him the least rights? Is derech haktzara, the shortest way. Now, there are two different ways to read ktzara. Ktzara can mean the one that impinges on other people's rights the least, and that's the derech haktzara. Or derech haktzara means the shortest distance between his field and the city. We grant him an access route in that direction. He's got to shell out. He's got to pay somebody to let him, give him access. If he doesn't want to pay, let him fly over to his field because he doesn't have a right to take away from the parties that are there. So since he has the right to take it away from them, he's got to pay for it. And they can extort money from him because he's really in a bad position. My time with the Rabbanan. What is the logic behind the Rabbanan's position? Shapir Kamar Admon. Admon has a very good claim over here. Because if this guy owns properties all around this isolated or island of a property, then Mimonav Shach, he has a way through here. We know he has a way through here. He doesn't own a field where he has no access to it. So it's clear that he owns an access route. And this guy who has fields all around him has got to grant them an access route. Some Rav Yudam Rav, Kigon Shikifua, Arba'a Bnei Adam, Me'arba Ruchuta. Well, you misunderstood. You thought, until this point, fields surrounding his field were all owned by one individual. Therefore, you can compel that one individual to give him access, because Mimonav Shach, there's a route there. On the other hand, what the Gemara is now explaining is that the properties around this field are owned by four different people. So now, if he walks up to one person and says, give me an access, he'll say, access wasn't in my field, it was in another guy's field. Next guy will say the same thing. He can't prove, he can't consolidate the claim against all these individuals because they're all different individuals. It's a single individual who can consolidate his claim and demand rights of access. But now that you're saying that it's four different individuals, he doesn't have a right to consolidate the claim and get access. So Mar says, Yochi, my diamond Admon. Now you gave such a good explanation for the Rambanan's position. What's the story with Admon now? Why does Admon allow you access when it's four different people going around? Rambanan have a great claim. So Amar Abu Rova ba'arba'a da'ati mikoach arba'a. If it was the case that four different people owned the fields around this guy's field, and then four different people bought from them, so they changed hands from the original owners to new owners, va'arba'a da'ati mikoach chad, or in the case where there was a single owner there, and he sold it, broke it up into parcels, and sold it to four different people on the four different boundaries, kuliyama lo pligi dematzi midachile. Everybody agrees, including Admon, that he can push him away. Because in each of these cases, he doesn't have ability to bring all the claims together and say, listen, I had a route here for sure, You got to get me a root. Because each one of the parties here is independent. And since they're independent, they can push him to go to the other party and say, listen, the other guy has it. And the other guy says, no, he has it. And he has no way to prove where that path was. And therefore, he has no rights over here, and he can't gain access to land. So even Admon would agree in these cases, he has no claim against these parties. But, keep legate, where's the machloket of our Mishnah? B'chad at mikoach arba'a. It's a case where the fields originally that surrounded this field were owned by four different parties, and now a single individual consolidated it and bought all of the properties. So now the machloket there is, Admon savar, mikomakom, darka idli gabeich. Now he says, look, now I have a consolidated claim. I'm going against one Baal Din now. That Baal Din owns all the properties. And he says, Mimonav Shach, in those four fields that you bought, I definitely own the path. You got to give me the path. Rabbanan Sabre, Ishatakt, Shatakt. If you're silent, good. Vilo, Mahadranan Shtar, Lamarayu. Otherwise, I'm going to give back the Shtar to the original owners. Vilo, Matsi, Lashtui, Dine, Baadayu. And then you'll have no rights whatsoever. In the original scenario where there are four different owners of these fields, he would have had no rights because he can't consolidate the claim. So the guy says to him, listen, either you deal with me. If you don't deal with me, I'm just going to give the shtariot back, and now you're going to be stuck because then you won't be able to deal with anyone. There is a machloket here amongst the Rishonim as to what exactly the carrot and the stick is over here. Rashi claims, and you can see there's Gemaras do have a slightly different girsa in it that supports this version of Rashi, which is, Ishatak shatak vozil gabech. He says, look, if you just pipe down now and don't make a claim against me, I'll sell it to you for a discounted price. If you don't like that, I'm going to return the fields to the original owners, and then you'll never be able to get it because every party is going to say you don't have rights here, and you don't have rights, so I'm going to push you on the other person, and they're going to extort huge amounts of money from you in order to get a path through it. So listen, I'll give you a good deal. I'm sure it's not a good deal, but I'll give you a better deal than those other four parties might give you. And therefore, just be quiet and take the deal that I'm offering you, because otherwise, I'm going to return the contracts, and then you'll have nothing. As Tosfos points out of here, this claim only works where it's one guy buying from four. But if one guy bought from one, then that would not be the case. Because when a guy bought from one, the first guy was also obligated to give a path. And then when the second guy buys it, he's just as obligated to give a path. And that is because when parties sell property, they sell the property with the embedded rights that they have in the property. So in this instance, if one guy owns all the properties before and sells it to another single party, over there, the next party has no more rights than the first party had there. And just like the first party, if he owned all the fields around here, would have to grant them a way through, so to the second party who bought it from him and now owns all the fields around him, will have to grant him access because the person with the field in the middle had rights, had a right of claim against him that he could get a path no matter what. And when the first guy sold it to the second guy, he sold it with that embedded right in there, which is the right for the other party to get his path through there. On the other hand, when four people sell it to a single individual, each one of those four people had a right to push away this guy looking for his path and say, no, it's not here for you. So when one guy consolidates and buys all those properties together, he bought with that their rights. Their rights were to push away this guy looking for access to his field in the middle. So too, when this guy has consolidated all the properties and bought them all, he too has a right to push him away and say that you don't have rights over here. Now in the end, Tosfos does bring the pshat of Rashi and brings that alternative girsa. But nevertheless, Tosfos doesn't think that it fits in because the vozil the gabech, that I'll make it cheaper for you, does not appear in the Gemara. And number two is, he says, the Mishnah says, ikach b'mei amaneh, which basically means that the guy has free reign to charge him as he pleases. So it doesn't sound like he's giving him any discount. It sounds like he can extort as much money as he wants from this individual. And so what Tosfos says is, this guy has full rights here to be medache him and say, I'm not giving you a pathway through here. Since he purchased it from these four people, and they had the right to do it, he purchased that same right, and he can basically say, I'll return the contracts to them. Not that he literally has to return the contracts to them, but just the fact that he could return the contracts to them means that he has the same rights that they do have. The same rights that they have is to push this guy away, and he has that same right to push him away. So the carrot and the stick, according to Tosfos, are, listen, you have no rights here, because I bought this from four people, and if I return the shtarot, you'd have nothing. So when I bought this and consolidated all the property around it, you still have no rights over here. And therefore, you pay what I ask. Otherwise, you don't get anything. The carrot, in this case, will be pay whatever I tell you to pay, any exorbitant amount. And the stick is that if not, I could return these contracts to the other parties, and then you'd lose everything, because then you can't make a claim against anybody, and therefore, you have no rights over here, you have no claim over here. So as opposed to Rashi, who thinks that the carrot and stick here is, I'm giving you a better price, and if you don't listen to me, then I'm going to literally return the contracts to the other parties, and then you'd lose everything, because then you can't make a claim against anybody, so take the discounted price that I'm giving you, because yes, you might have a right to the field. Now that I've consolidated it, you might have a right to get a path here, but that right to a path is also subject to this threat that I can give back the contracts to the other parties. And so because of that, you've got to listen to what I ask in terms of price, because otherwise you're going to get nothing, and they're going to extort a lot more money from you. So that's the difference between Tosafot and Rashi's explanations of the Gemara. Tosafot does point out that you cannot say in a case where it's a single guy that owns all the property around and say to him, listen, I'm not giving you a derech because I can go sell this to four people. If I sell it to four people, you have no rights, so you better listen to me. Tosafot says that doesn't work because shelo yachol afkia dino yidei mechirato hol v'kodem shebal yado lo yarui lamarkein, because he didn't have a right to say this before the claimants came in. The only time we allow them to make such a claim is if this claim existed before the party came. So in the case of the one guy who consolidated and bought all four properties and brought them together, in that case, his claim existed before the individual whose field is in the middle showed up. His claim basically was, I can return the contracts. He could have said that whether or not the guy was here. So now, in the case where he shows up and asks for an access to his field, he can at that point make the claim, I could return the shtarot to their original owners. But in the case where, when the guy shows up, he says, listen, if you don't listen to me and take what I want you to take, or pay what I want you to pay, I'm going to sell this to four people, and then you'll really be stuck. Over there, that claim didn't exist, or wasn't there, until the guy showed up. And the guy showed up, all of a sudden he says, I'm selling it. No, that claim wasn't there, that doesn't exist yet, and therefore it's not a real claim. So Tosafot differentiates between a pre-existing or ability to make a claim where the sale was already done, and therefore you can threaten him with saying, I'm going to give the contracts back, versus a case where in the future I will sell it. It's not really a threat because we don't listen to that. We don't pay heed to that because that's something in the future. That's not a claim that exists right now. Okay, how would Amar Lu Dikla Lebrat? There was an individual on his deathbed that says, the palm tree goes to my daughter. Azo Yatme, Apolog the Nechsai. They split up the property of the mate. Lo Yavula Dikla, but they didn't give her a palm tree. Sabra of Yosef de Meimar, I know Matznitin. That's our Mishnah. She has a claim for a palm tree. The problem is that the property once belonged to her father, which was a single property, and then they could have given her a palm tree. But now that the property is now subdivided between all of the brothers, she goes to any brother, that brother will say to her, listen, the palm tree is in the other guy's piece. Palm tree is in the other guy's piece. And I can push her around, and she won't get anywhere because you can't bring a consolidated claim against all of them. She can only go one by one, and each one of them say it's in the other guy's field, it's not in my field. So that's what Rav Yosef thought, that this case is very similar to our case of our Mishnah. Amalei Abaye, so his Talmud Abaye says, Midomi, how can you compare the cases? Abaye appears prominently in this whole sugya in today's daf. He qualified the previous Mishnah a number of times, and in this Mishnah again, he's saying to Rav Yosef that do not extrapolate from our Mishnah to this case. Because, Midomi, Otom kol chad v'chad matzi midachelei. Over there, each individual can say, look, the path is not in my field. Go to the other guy, the path is not in my field. Hocha dikla gabayu. Here we know for sure that there is a dekel there that belongs to her. The father granted her a dekel. There's no question that one of these dekelim belongs to her, and that they divided the property knowing that. And since this came out of a consolidated estate that was given out to them, then there's certainly an obligation to give that palm tree. So my taknatayu. What should they do? How do they solve this problem? Leit vela dikla, they give her one of the palm trees. Vela haju velif legumeresha, and then redivide the assets of the estate, knowing now that somebody just lost a palm tree from his field, and now we have to reassess the values of everything that's there, and then subdivide it between the brothers. You have to do a new division that excludes this dekel that was given to the sister. How damar lo dikla levrat? Again, a case where an individual says, this dekel belongs to my daughter, in his will or in his shchiv meira, on his deathbed, says that the dekel should go to my daughter. Shochiv v'shavik trei palge de dikla. He passed away, and he left behind two palm trees in which he was a partner, a 50% partner in it. So he was a 50% partner in palm tree A, 50% partner in palm tree B, And then, according to Rashi, there were a whole bunch more. He had many more palm trees that were, he owed them fully and wholly. Yoti Ravashi, Vikakashile. Mi karu inche, the trade palga de dikle, dikla. Do people call 2 50% partnerships a deco, a palm tree? Although, or maybe not. Amarle Rav Mordechai the Ravashi. So Rav Mordechai pipes up and says, Ravashi, Hachi Amar Rav Yimei me Agronaya, Mishmei de Rova. This we have in a Mesora from Rova. Karu Incha, the trade palga dikla, dikla. People do call 2 50% partnerships, one in A and one in B. If you consolidate the 2 50% partnerships, then you own a whole dekel. People do call that a dekel, even though it's made up of 2 50% pieces. So that's the way to read it, according to Rashi, who says that the Tomim have plenty of palm trees. They just want to give her the two that involve the partnerships, because they're much harder to manage, and involve another partner. And so because of that, they want to give her that, which is the least value out of the estate that they can give to their sister. And therefore, they say, take those two half the kalim. And Ravashi is trying to figure out if those two half the kalim that he owns through the partnerships are considered to be a single deco. And the answer in the end is yes. There are others who say that this was the only dekalim that the father owned. He only owned a partnership in two dekalim, 50% partnership in two dekalim. So now the brothers wanted to disenfranchise her completely and say she doesn't get anything. There's no palm tree here that my father owns that she should get. So then Ravashi says, well, the question is, do we call two half palm trees a palm tree? If that's the case, if we do call it that, then she's entitled to those two half palm trees. If we don't, then she's not entitled to it. And the answer in the end was, yes, we do call two half partnerships in these palm trees to be considered or classified as a single palm tree. And she would be entitled to the palm tree, and the Yutomim will get whatever else is left in the estate. Even though there are no other palm trees in the estate, she is given this palm tree because that must be what he was referencing. Okay, we'll stop over here by the top of Kuf Vav Amud Aleph by the Mishnah.